Hey there, it's Frank Buckley. Today it's a conversation with Jeffrey Toobin. Readers of The New Yorker will know the name. He's a longtime staff writer there. You might also know him from one of his many books, including The Run of His Life, The People versus O.J. Simpson, or The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court, or The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. I first met Jeffrey when we were both covering the O.J. Simpson trial a million years ago, and then we were colleagues for a period of time at CNN. Jeffrey is still there as the network's chief legal analyst. Before he went into journalism and writing, Jeffrey was a federal prosecutor working as an assistant U.S. attorney working out of Brooklyn, New York. He was also associate counsel in the office of independent counsel Lawrence Walsh, where he worked on the Iran-Contra case. Jeffrey has a new book, True Crimes and Misdemeanors, The Investigation of Donald Trump. And that's what we'll talk about during today's show. And we got in a few extra questions on this audio podcast that didn't make it onto the TV show. Here's our show with Jeffrey Toobin.
No collusion, no obstruction.
President Trump survived the two-year-long Mueller investigation, then became only the third president in American history to be impeached. But he survived that, too.
It is, therefore, ordered and adjudged that the said Donald John Trump be, and he is hereby, acquitted of the charges in said articles.
It was an impeachment trial that CNN chief legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin called at the time a sham.
What really amazes me is the John Thunes, the Susan Collins, who say the president has learned his lesson.
Yeah.
No, he has not. No, he has not. He is going to do this again. He said he will do it again. And the idea that there is some chastening here is absurd.
CNN's chief legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin writes about all of it in his new book, True Crimes and Misdemeanors, The Investigation of Donald Trump. And I am delighted to welcome Jeffrey Toobin to the program. It is good to see you. Thanks for coming on with us. How you doing?
I'm good, Frank. You know, that's not just a social pleasantry these days. You know, you have to be very grateful to be doing good these days.
Absolutely.
My family and I are fine.
Well, great. It's great to see you. Join. You cover a lot of ground in this new book. From the investigation, the initial investigation of the links between the Trump campaign and the Russians who were interfering in the 2016 election, to the Congressional Intelligence Committee investigations of President Trump, to the Mueller investigation, to ultimately the impeachment and President Trump's acquittal in the impeachment trial. And I'd like to start with the Mueller investigation. Folks will remember that Robert Mueller, the former FBI director, was appointed special counsel by Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. He spent 22 months investigating Russia's involvement in our 2016 election. The investigation resulted in a number of President Trump's closest advisors being convicted of crimes, being found guilty, and all 34 people were indicted as a result of the investigation. And you argue in your book, and here are some of the folks who were found guilty on the screen, that, and many experts agree, that the investigation that revealed that President Trump broke the law too, and yet what came out of the investigation ultimately and the impeachment trial was President Trump saying no collusion, no obstruction. And they would say, what was the point?
Well, I think there was very much a point. And you know, the fact that the president was not removed from office, that was not Mueller's goal. That was not even his responsibility. I think that has more to do with the contemporary state of the Republican Party, which is sort of a Trump cult at this point, rather than the state of the evidence. As you suggested, I do think that the Mueller investigation did some very important things, prosecuted some very high-level people, and in its report, you know, identified and with great specificity the enormous efforts that Russia went to in 2016 to help Donald Trump win the election, and it also identified what I thought was very clear evidence of criminal conduct by the president in terms of obstruction of justice. I do not think there was any criminality in connection with, you know, the so-called collusion issue, the issue of his ties to Russia. So, you know, I do think it's fair for the president to say no collusion, but no obstruction. I think that's dead wrong.
And you argue in your book that if the president had been called to a face-to-face interview with Robert Mueller instead of having to submit to written questions, that that would have been made evidently clear, because you say the president would have lied.
Absolutely. And you know, as I say, I think the Mueller office accomplished a great deal. I think there were two major flaws in the investigation. The first one, as you suggest, is the failure to subpoena the president and force him to testify under oath instead of allowing him to answer those written questions, which were basically written by his lawyers as much as they were written by him. So, yes, I do think it was a failing that they didn't get the president to testify under oath. And the other failing, I think, was the failure to state clearly in the final report that the president committed the crime of obstruction of justice.
Robert Mueller had said that he was constrained by the Department of Justice policies that said that a sitting president cannot be indicted for crimes. And yet he never went as far as saying, despite that, we believe these specific crimes were committed. What were those crimes in your mind?
I think it was several acts of obstruction of justice, frankly, much more serious than the crimes that forced Richard Nixon to be forced from office and the crimes that got Bill Clinton impeached. When you look at what Donald Trump did, when you look at the way he tried to coerce his FBI director, James Comey, to go easy on the National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn, and then fired Comey when he wouldn't do it. When you saw his efforts through his White House counsel, Don McGahn, to fire Mueller and then to tell McGahn to lie about those encounters. I thought those were classic acts of obstruction of justice. I do think the Mueller was barred by Department of Justice policy that says you can't indict a sitting president. I think actually that policy is correct. I think under our constitutional system, we can't have a president who's sitting in court as a defendant all day. But I didn't think that policy mandated the refusal to state clearly what Trump had done. And that I thought Mueller really pulled that punch. And that had really unfortunate impact, not least because it allowed William Barr, the president's very subservient attorney general, to distort what Mueller had concluded and minimize what Trump had done.
And given that, and you say that it was still important that Robert Mueller conducted this investigation and laid this groundwork, does that work then move over somewhere else? Is this something that the Southern District of New York takes on in its investigations? Does this Justice Department, under a future administration, in either at the end of this term or at the end of President Trump's next term, if he's reelected, do they use that against Mr. Trump then?
I don't think. I mean, we don't know for sure. I mean, obviously, we don't know if the outcome of the election or the outcome of the next election. But I don't think the United States Department of Justice, even if Biden wins, is going to pursue the president. And I think that's the correct decision. You know, if Joe Biden wins, he has a very long agenda of things to do, starting with the pandemic and the economy. And if the former president were to be indicted, that would suck up all the oxygen out of Washington. That would dominate the news. I think it would weaken the new President Biden, and I don't think he wants any part of that. However, there is the issue of the Manhattan District Attorney, who is also investigating President Trump, and will, I think, soon obtain the president's tax returns, obtain his financial records. I do think if the Manhattan DA, Cyrus Vance, gets evidence that there is clearly criminal behavior, evidence that I don't know if it exists, I do think he will bring a case, but I don't think the Department of Justice will.
And I know you were disappointed, or I mean, I shouldn't make the assumption that you were disappointed, but you make the point that Robert Mueller did not seek the financial records of Donald Trump, of President Trump, during his investigation. What were your thoughts on that?
Well, I am critical of Mueller in several areas, as I mentioned. I think that's a very tough call, and I think Mueller took a defensible position on that. You know, Trump's financial records were not part of the jurisdiction that Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, gave Mueller. Mueller was told to investigate ties between Russia and the Trump campaign and any investigation arising out of that. Now, one of the great unanswered questions has always been, what is it about Vladimir Putin and Russia that has made Trump so solicitous over these years? Is there some financial connection there? But that's frankly somewhat far afield from the assignment that Mueller got. He was very concerned with not going beyond his charter. He also didn't want to spend years and years the way Kenneth Starr spent years, the way that Lawrence Walsh spent years investigating the Iran-Contra. So I think there were a lot of countervailing pressures on Mueller, and I can understand why he didn't go after the financial stuff.
All right, Jeffrey, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, Steve Bannon just arrested this week. We're going to ask Jeffrey Toobin what he thinks about that.
The president has repeatedly claimed that your report found there was no obstruction and that it completely and totally exonerated him. But that is not what your report said, is it?
Correct. That is not what the report said.
Robert Mueller testifying before the House Judiciary Committee. There were things that were said in that in the actual report that was issued by Robert Mueller that seemed nonsensical. I'm not going to quote them back because it was so much legalese about obstruction or conspiracy, and it wasn't really clear to me in reading it as a layman, but I'm asking you to sort of decipher, what was he trying to tell us at the end of the day? Because he didn't seem to articulate it.
Well, this deals with the question of obstruction of justice. And as we've discussed, you know, there is this Department of Justice policy that says Mueller, as a subordinate of the Attorney General, couldn't indict the president. And I think that, and there's no question that was the policy. But Mueller went further. He said, well, because I can't indict the president, he can't have his day in court to respond to whatever I might accuse him of. So I am not going to say my conclusions of what he did. And I thought that was, frankly, legal gobbledygook. He was a prosecutor. He was assigned to investigate the president. He found evidence that was clearly criminal, I think, when it came to obstruction of justice. He laid out that evidence. But then, as you say, he came up with this very convoluted set of reasons why he wouldn't say what he said, you know, conclude what the evidence showed. And I thought that revealed a certain overly legalistic, overly protective attitude on the part of Mueller. That, you know, was bad enough on its own, but I think indicated some real naivete about the political situation in Washington, because by leaving that question open, he left William Barr to completely exonerate the president. And that in a really unfair and misleading way. And I think Mueller could have seen that was coming if he was somewhat more politically savvy. But, you know, Mueller is an old school guy and he trusts institutions. He's lived his whole life within institutions, the Marine Corps, the Department of Justice, the FBI, and he trusted the Justice Department to handle his report correctly. And I think he was quite betrayed by that trust.
It's one of the things that I love about your writing, whether it's in this book or in The New Yorker, Jeffrey. You take us behind the scenes to help us not just see what everyone is seeing, but help us understand what people are thinking or going through. And you really, in this book, at the beginning of the book and at the end of the book, gave us a sense of the two most prominent sort of characters in this drama, Robert Mueller and President Trump. And you, and the way you described it was that they were photo negatives of each other. Trump could not tell the truth. Mueller could not tell a lie.
You know, I opened the book with the one time in either of their lives that they met each other, May 16th, 2017. And, you know, it was really a tableau, a set piece about these two men. And that's really what the book is about. It's about how this investigation unfolded and what is the behind-the-scenes story. They have a lot in common, actually, when you think about it. Both of them born during World War II. Both of them come from wealthy families. Mueller's father was an executive at DuPont. Both of them went to Ivy League schools, Penn and Princeton, but they have completely diverged in how they've lived their lives. Mueller has done almost nothing except public service his whole life. Donald Trump has worked for Donald Trump his whole life. And their public demeanor and their relationship to the truth, as you point out, could not be more different. But the other thing is that Trump reflects the contemporary United States a lot more than Robert Mueller does, for better or for worse. And I think he was able to use that knowledge to survive this investigation.
And for Mr. Mueller, in looking back at the results of all of this, despite 22 months of intense investigation and a number of people found guilty at very high levels, Do you have a sense that he is disappointed, upset about how he's framed in history? Can you give us some insight into that?
I think the ending was disappointing at many levels. I think, you know, the fact that he was betrayed by William Barr, someone he worked with in the George Herbert Walker Bush administration, I think that was very disappointing. I think he had this very old school idea of prosecutors as people who only talk in the courtroom, not in public. He fought having to testify in Congress. We see the video up there. And it was a bad experience at every level. He didn't want to be there. And he had aged. He was 74. And there are a lot of different ways you can be 74. And the two-year investigation had taken a toll on him. I think he knows that he was portrayed poorly, and so I think the experience is not a happy one, but is one that I think he views as his responsibility, his obligation as a citizen, and that's the kind of obligations that he's taken up his whole life.
This week, Steve Bannon was arrested. He's being charged with fraud in a scheme with others to take donations to help build the border wall, and according to prosecutors, take that some of that money for himself. Does this surprise you? And where is that information going to go? In other words, are they going to just go after Steve Bannon, or are they arresting him for some other ends?
Well, I think, you know, responsible prosecutors like these people, you know, they do one case at a time, and I think they are prosecuting him for this crime, which looks fairly straightforward. I mean, in the indictment, there were all these representations made to contributors, $25 million worth of contributions, that the money was all going to go to build the wall. It asserts that not only did they lie, but that they conspired to mislead everyone by shuffling money around in ways so that it wouldn't be clear that they put hundreds of thousands of dollars into their own pockets. You know, there were a lot of people, prominent people, involved in this wall charity. Donald Trump Jr. spoke there. The Chris Kobach, the Kansas politician. Sheriff Clark, who's a fixture on Fox News, you know, they all were involved in this charity in one way or another. What, if anything, they knew about the corruption is certainly something that the prosecutors are going to want to find out. And the other thing is, Bannon is, I mean, you know, 90+% of people who are indicted in federal court are convicted or plead guilty. Plus, he's the biggest target of the four defendants in these cases.
Yeah.
And what almost always happens in those situations is that one or more of the others flip, turn on him, because that helps you get a lower sentence. So I think Bannon is in deep, deep trouble. Mm.
All right. We're going to take a short break. President Trump has said he may not accept the results of the 2020 election. What will happen then? We'll ask Jeffrey Toobin when we come back. We're back with Jeffrey Toobin. And Jeffrey, the question that I asked before the break, if President Trump does not accept the results of the election, this is assuming that he doesn't win. I'm assuming he would accept the results if he wins. If he doesn't win, what happens then?
Well, you know, that would be uncharted territories. I think, obviously, if it's a dispute, it would wind up in court. And the question is, would he honor the results of litigation, and how far would he go with it? We have the precedent of Bush v. Gore, where Al Gore accepted that the Supreme Court shut down the recount, and thus he had lost that election. I think it would be. A more dramatic and difficult situation if an incumbent president refused to accept results. But I have to say, I do have enough confidence in the institutions of our country that if the outcome is, in favor of Biden, ultimately Biden will become president next January 20th. But, you know, I don't know for sure. And as the president likes to say, we'll see what happens.
Could be a long night for you on election night, or a long few weeks or months.
Weeks.
Your book is dedicated to your fellow journalists. Why?
Because it's been a rough time for journalism in terms of the business, how newspapers in particular and magazines have suffered because of the internet, but also because of the criticism, the fake news, the enemy of the people, criticism from the president and others. And I just wanted to make clear, as someone who didn't start as a journalist, I was a lawyer, I was a prosecutor, that I feel very honored and grateful to be a journalist, and I'm proud of the work we do, and I'm glad that we're still free to do it.
The CNN that you work at now is not the CNN that I was at when I left in 2005. The anchors there today seem to take much more of a position when they're questioning people, and I wonder, is that a result of this president, or is it a change in the way cable news happens now?
That's a great question, Frank. Clearly, you're correct about how CNN has changed in the demeanor and the attitude of not just the anchors, but I think the whole news operation. I think a lot, some of it has to do with Trump, but also I think it's the evolution of the news business. I think, and this is just my sense, no one's ever told me this, but, by the time you get to prime time in cable news now, everybody who's watching already knows the news from their phones in broad outlines. It's like people are so online so much now that the headlines are already in people's heads by the time they get to prime time. So the argument has to be, tell me something I don't know. Tell me something that I haven't heard before. And I think that tends to be more in the nature of opinion than news. Look, we know that Fox, was an enormous success because it became a conservative network. MSNBC kind of stumbled into the role of being the liberal alternative. There was a period, I think, shortly after you left CNN, actually, where, CNN couldn't exactly figure out where it was. It was sort of the boring alternative, and that was not a good place to be. So I think the more aggressive, opinionated take that you see is where we are now, and frankly, I'm comfortable with that.
And let me ask you, for in your role as a legal observer, as a writer for The New Yorker, as an author, as a chief legal analyst for CNN, do you feel compelled to take a point of view when you analyze a given situation? Or do you try to present both points of view? Or what is your role as a legal observer?
Well, you know, Frank, I view that my role has changed. You know, I joined CNN when you were still there in 2002. And at that time, I felt like my role was very much just sort of describe what the issue was, simplify it, you know, put to get rid of the legalese, and, you know, give the arguments on both sides. I feel like I am asked and licensed by my bosses to express more of an opinion now about the merits of certain arguments. Now, I always try to label those arguments as my own impression, you know, the question of like what a court is going to do with a specific issue. But I do think I have become more voicey, if that's a word. And again, I think that's part of the evolution of cable news. And, you know, I try not to abuse that privilege, but I do give my opinion.
You touched on Republicans and their acquiescence, or however you described it, to President Trump's point of view. You have people like Lindsey Graham, who once called Donald Trump a race-baiting, xenophobic bigot, a kook who's unfit for office. And now Lindsey Graham is one of President Trump's biggest supporters in the Senate. You must talk to some of these folks when the cameras are not on. What do they tell you about their personal evolutions, if you will, or how they've changed?
Well, I think there are a couple things going on. One is fear. You know, Donald Trump dominates the Republican Party like no politician has dominated any political party in my lifetime. The Republicans are terrified that he will, that he will get angry at them and support a primary opponent, because it has happened more than a few times that Trump has turned on Republicans who have defied him, and they've lost their jobs. So there's just plain fear. The other thing is, because of the fear, there's a lot of excuse making for Donald Trump. It's like, well, you hear this. I hear this all the time. It's like, well, I don't like the tweets, but I'm really glad he appointed all these conservative judges. I'm really glad he cut taxes. I'm glad he got rid of regulations. So I'll put up with, you know, the circus like Trump. You know, whether that's sincere or not, or just a manifestation of lack of political courage, you know, I can't answer that for sure. But, you know, you are right that the Republicans behind closed doors, they know what kind of person Donald Trump really is.
Final question. You worked in the Department of Justice. You were an assistant U.S. attorney prosecuting the bad guys. The Department of Justice is a very different place than the one you worked at. And it is still made up of people, I believe, who believe in justice. But it has been tainted. And I just wonder, in speaking to your former colleagues there, what are they going through? And are you worried about how we in the public regard the Department of Justice and justice in this country?
It's painful, Frank. I mean, everybody knows in the Department of Justice that the Attorney General is a political appointee, and that's always been the case. But there has also been the sense that the Department of Justice operates somewhat independently of politics. And I think what we've seen from Attorney General Barr, whether it's, you know, moving to reduce the sentence of Roger Stone or dismiss the case against Michael Flynn, or, you know, reinvestigate the origins of the Russia investigation because he didn't like it. That is a politicization that I have not seen, even going back to the days of Richard Nixon. And I think, as with so many other things, the outcome of the 2020 election will tell us a lot, because if the president is reelected, we're going to see more of this. We're going to see the Department of Justice acting more like the president's lawyer than the people's lawyer. I have a lot of confidence, though, that if there is a new crew in there, they will restore some of the traditions that I think are really so important, not just on the merits, but also in terms of how justice is perceived in this country.
Jeffrey, thank you so much for your time, sir.
All righty, Frank. Thank you.
Good to talk to you. Hope you enjoyed the conversation with Jeffrey Toobin. If you have some feedback, tag me on social media at Frank Buckley TV on Twitter. I read all of your comments, even the critical stuff. But if you're rude about it, make sure you get in a good one because you'll be blocked from commenting in the future. We drop a new podcast every Wednesday and we air our TV shows on the weekend on KTLA. And you can see all of the shows after they air on TV on YouTube. Just search for Frank Buckley Interviews. Thanks for listening this week, and until next time, I'll see you on TV.